Come gather round now and listen up well. Though the song I'll sing you has nothing new to tell. See throughout all the ages, without pretense, the few have gotten wealthy at everyone's expense. For instance, a few years back, in the mortgage field, it was take the lowest risk for the highest yield. Bundled up their lives, sold them to the highest bidder, and then they act surprised when it hit the shitter. It's a great big mess, you know it's true. What in the world are folks supposed to do? I know, let's blame the teachers. They're easy prey, and they're used to taking grief every day. It's the same old story, and it's the age-old game. You get the bailouts, we get the blame.
Tom McCutcheon, you get the bailout, and we get the blame. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the Listen Now button. And KKRN is also a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. Your support keeps us on the air. Once again, go to KKRN and click on the Donate button. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. And you can call that if you're hearing us streaming on the internet. That means you're hearing us live. So you can call and use that same number to call and make comments. Our guest today is Ellen Brown. Ellen Brown is an attorney, founder of the Public Banking Institute, and author of 12 books and over 200 articles. In Web of Debt, her latest book, she shows how private banking cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we, the people, can get it back. In the Public Bank Solution, in the Public Bank Solution is actually her latest, it's a sequel to the Web of Debt. She traces the evolution of two banking models that have competed historically, public and private, and explores contemporary public banking systems globally. She also co-authored the best-selling Nature's Pharmacy, which has sold over 285,000 copies. She is a 2014 candidate for California State Treasurer, running with the Green Party endorsement. She is a regular columnist and blogger on a number of prominent internet sites, including the Huffington Post, Common Dreams, and Truth Out. She has appeared on numerous television shows, including Tom Hartman and Democracy Now!, which we air daily here on KKRN during the week. I have read her articles for several years. I find her to be one of the few that quite clearly and knowledgeably talks about banking, finance, and geopolitics. I want to welcome Ellen Brown. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Thank you, Doug.
It's good to have you on the show. And I have to ask you, this is a question, and now you can be considered a politician, so you're fair game. So, but I want to ask you, what possessed you to get into politics? I know it had to be a really, and it is, it's an ongoing thing since the primaries were just Tuesday. So,
and I think it was in the category of fools rush in, not knowing what I was getting into. But actually, there were two Greens who asked me, and I said, sure. Not knowing what I was getting into, but I, of course, I knew that it was an unlikely win. I wanted to get the whole state bank idea out there, and which I did. So I guess that was useful. But I didn't realize that it was so much work. I mean, I had to I resigned temporarily from as president of the Public Banking Institute. I just don't have time to do everything. They make it really difficult for third party. Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose for anybody, but you really need, for one thing, you need a staff, which I didn't have. So you really need somebody to fill out all those forms, and you need somebody who knows what they're doing. I mean, at first, I was just totally flying blind. I mean, after a while, people would give me tips. You should be doing this. You should be doing that. But there really wasn't any guidance. You know, it's not like being with one of the big parties where they provide you with corporate funding and they set up your itinerary for you and all those things.
Yeah, yeah. So. You pretty much, well, like you say, you use it as a platform, and with the two-party system we have now, if I can still call it that, they seem to be united on anything that Wall Street wants to do. So I wouldn't really call them a two-party system anymore, but it's pretty hard for any other party. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we don't really have like a parliamentary system like the British and other countries have, where a smaller party can actually have a voice in government. I guess there's very few, a couple of independent congressmen and senators out there, but they're few and far between. So
yeah. Well, the one good thing was to get you can get a ballot statement in front of all the voters for $25 a word. I guess you can. I never got one. I hope people got them. I didn't get one, and my mother didn't get one. But anyway, it was supposed to be in the voter guide. Apparently, there are two guides that come, at least in L.A. I mean, I got the one that had the local statements in it, but it didn't have the statewide statements. But anyway, so I put in my ballot statement. It cost $3,200 at $25 a word. I did like about half the maximum, and theoretically that goes to all the voters. So it cost $75,000 for an ad in the L.A. Times, a full page ad. So it's relatively cheap advertising.
Yeah, that's interesting, because money's still a factor, even just to get a statement out about why you're running. Money's become a factor.
It used to not be. It used to not be, but now it used to be you could get on with 150 signatures. Now it's 10,000 signatures and $25 a word. It used to be you got your ballot statement in there for free, and it's about $3,000 to run if you don't have the signatures, so that whatever you get in the way of signatures reduces that. So I think I paid $2,300 or something for the filing fee. So it's all a bit pricey and a lot of work. Filling out their forms is like doing taxes every month.
It's what Bill Gates would call the barrier to entry.
They don't make it easy.
No.
But on the other hand, I did generate a lot of interest in public banking, and apparently John Chang, who is the likely winner for treasurer, he emailed someone else and said he wanted more information on public banking. So that would be my whole goal, if I could get this administration to get interested in public banking. It seems to me it's a no-brainer. I mean, it's not like we're trying to say you should tax the rich or do more for the poor or anything that's really controversial. We're saying, here's a way you can save a lot of money. The only parties that it will be controversial for is Wall Street, and that's not us. I mean, Wall Street is in New York. They're not here in L.A., and they're proven crooks. They've been caught in a number. J.P. Morgan Chase has been caught in over a dozen major frauds. The 16 largest banks in the world have been caught in the LIBOR scandal, which is the LIBOR is the benchmark interest rate for over $400 trillion in interest rate swaps. So we're doing business with proven criminals.
Yeah,
well, I guess they're not criminals, because that Attorney General Eric Holder says they're too big to prosecute, and therefore they only go for civil fraud. But the elements of civil fraud are the same as the elements for criminal fraud. It's just that the standard of burden of proof is a little higher, but they've satisfied all the elements for criminal fraud. That's what they have done, engaged in fraud, and we're still dealing with them because we think we have no alternative, but we actually do. We can set up our own bank on the model of the Bank of North Dakota, or there's several other models. We don't have to follow North Dakota, but the good of the Bank of North Dakota is it's been there for 100 years almost. It proves it can be done. It proves that it's very effective, and it saves the state a lot of money. Proves it's constitutional, and you know, it's not like we're breaking new ground here. We're just following this modest little conservative state in out in the Midwest or mid whatever they are, the middle of the country.
Yes. And I think it's wonderful you're pointing that out. And, of course, the corruption is so great, and you said it's not going to hurt anybody. But of course, J.P. Morgan Chase, who is Chase Bank, and Bank of America, all the major banks would certainly be hurt by it because it would somehow cut into their exorbitant profits. And anything that seems to disturb anybody's profit seems to be out of bounds for a criminal prosecution or any other kind of prosecution, maybe a slap on the wrist, but nothing that would stop them from their fraudulent behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You're fighting an uphill battle there, I'm sure. And, of course, when it comes right down to it, they will exert monetary and political pressure because they can. In America these days, so it's a wonderful idea, and hopefully we could see something happening. Is it well? Let me ask you that question: Is it happening? Do we have some of these public banks sprouting up in America?
It hasn't happened yet, but there's certainly a lot of interest, and there are a lot of groups working on it. We have 20 states that have introduced bills of one sort or another for publicly owned banks. And one of them is California. We had a bill that passed both houses of the legislature in 2011 for a feasibility study for a state-owned bank. And Jerry Brown then refused to sign it. He said, we have plenty of committees. We don't need another committee. We can do this in-house. But they never did it. They haven't done anything on it. So it was just a way to bury it, apparently.
Mm.
Or maybe they just are waiting for somebody to put They're waiting to generate some interest. I don't know. I mean, it seems to me politicians are very conservative, and they're sort of in that make me do it, good idea, make me do it. What Roosevelt said, you know, like get a big popular wave of support, and maybe I'll consider it.
Well, Obama said that too, but it doesn't seem to matter what the people want. It's been my experience and my observation. We've had so many things like, public health care, the public option ignored. I think 60 or 70% of the public wanted it, totally ignored in Obamacare. So many things. I mean, most of the people are against war historically, and it doesn't seem to matter. You know, they do what they'll do. They'll try to sell it to you. If they can't sell it to you, they'll force it down your throat. So we have basically become powerless as the American public because we don't seem to even have any effect over our own representative. So
right. And yeah. what I just wrote about in California, this top two primary has killed all the third parties. No third party or independent will be on the ballot in November in the statewide election.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Yeah.
Yeah, so it certainly looks like an intentional move to, there's independents are suddenly now 40% of voters. I mean, voters are disillusioned with both major parties. So there's a growing movement for independents and third parties, and yet it used to be there were third parties on the ballot, and it used to be that you had the option to write in candidates, and that's been a right of Californians ever since 1850 when the Constitution was signed. But none of that will.
So now this so-called Orwellian so-called open primary is eliminating other voices.
Right. So you're down to two, but of course we know that those two are both heavily corporate funded. So there's nobody who's representing the 99%. I mean, it's not that I think all Democrats are bad or anything. I mean, it's not that I think they all have evil intent. Certainly many people in government are doing their best to try to help the people, but they all have to cater to big business because that's where they get their money. There's nobody that can just speak up independently for the people. As, for example, in Richmond, California. The mayor is a green, Gail McLaughlin, and she stood up to Chevron and got a big tax settlement out of them for taxes they hadn't paid. Chevron was the big Chevron mm-hmm. basically owns Richmond, and now she's standing up to the big banks and pushing through on this eminent domain idea where they will take back mortgages by eminent domain that are heavily underwater and renegotiate them on behalf of the homeowners. So nobody else would dare or could do that. That had to march to the drummer of the big corporations.
Mm. Yeah, let's talk. Let's go to basics, because my experience has been, and I talked to some pretty intelligent people, you know, off the air and on the air, and so many people do not understand the relationship of money and debt. And even we could take the example of a mortgage, a home mortgage. And so maybe you could, you know, kind of define the basics for listeners, because they really, most people do not understand this. They really don't.
Well, when you take out a mortgage, banks actually are not lending. The Bank of England just came out with a statement, their monthly bulletin or their quarterly bulletin. They said, contrary to popular belief, banks do not lend the money of their depositors. Whenever you take out a loan, they create new money on their books. They're creating credit on their books, and that's where virtually all of our money comes from bank loans. So if you go to the bank to take out a mortgage, they will write, say it was for a $200,000 mortgage, let's say. They will write $200,000 on one side of their books as an asset to themselves, because you have just agreed to pay them that sum over time plus interest. So you're actually going to pay double that over the whole course of the loan. And then they'll write $200,000 on the other side of their books as a liability to themselves, because when you write your check to the seller, they're going to have to cover that check. So they're going to have to get that money somewhere. But they don't actually, they pull it from their reserve account, which reflects their deposits. It's all, that part is pretty complicated. But they don't actually lend the deposits. The deposits are always there. You never go to the bank and they say, you never go and try to pull out your money and they say, I'm sorry, we just lent your money to your neighbor. You'll have to wait for 30 years till he pays off his loan. They can always find the money. And the reason is that they have these credit lines with all the other banks. So they can borrow from another bank at 0.25%, which is the Fed funds rate. So they can borrow for almost nothing to cover your check that goes out. Or they can borrow from their deposit pool. But the deposits, again, are still there. They have actually created a debt against their deposits in order to cover this check. So they're just slashing all these debits and credits around. They could arguably be borrowing back the very money they just created. So let's say you write a $200,000 check to your seller. That check goes into Bank B. Bank A now has a $200,000, they're that much short in their reserve account with the Federal Reserve, which they have to clear, so they have to get that $200,000 somewhere. And Bank B has $200,000 excess reserves, money that they can't lend right now, and they're happy to lend it back. So they will, Bank B will lend that very $200,000 that you just created in that check back to Bank A to clear their reserve account. They'll lend it at 0.25%. Mm-hmm. And that's how money comes into existence.
Let me remind our listeners here, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Our guest today is Ellen Brown, attorney, author, journalist, and candidate for treasurer in California. We are talking about the economy, the too big to fail banks, and possible solutions to continuing economic woes. The number here in the studio is 337-1885, 337-1885, if you've got comments or questions for Ellen. So back to the mortgage concept, they're lending you money that doesn't exist and charging you interest on money that they never really lent you. It's basically just entries in electronic ledgers and shuffling your money around electronically. Am I right?
Right.
So, so the average person usually thinks that somehow the bank actually gave them something. Yeah. Oh, and another facet of this, and I know this because I recently bought a new home, and I purposely went to a local bank. You know, I took my money out of Wells Fargo a couple of years ago with the 99% Move Your Money campaign, and I put it in a smaller bank, and I went in and I talked to them, and they said, "Yeah, of course, we'll approve your loan." And so we went through, and so I said, "So this loan stays here locally." And he said, "Oh no, hardly anybody does it anymore. Everybody sells them up immediately to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac."
Uh huh.
And so what that means to me is that my bank lent me money that didn't exist on paper, and then took that non-existent paper and went to a public institution and got real cash that they are now using.
Right. That your promise to pay is actually money. It's a negotiable instrument which the bank can then use, like you say, to get money. Mm. So really the function of the bank is to turn your promise to pay into money. If you went to the grocer and like you took your groceries and you said, "Let me write you an IOU, I'll pay you on Friday," the grocer probably wouldn't take it unless you're in a very small town and he knows you, because he doesn't know if you're good for the money or who you are or if you'll really come back. But if you go to the bank and you say, "Here's my IOU, I'll pay you some interest, and here's who I am, you know where you can find me, here's the collateral you can foreclose against if I don't pay," the bank will take your IOU, and then the bank turns your IOU into something that you can spend, that you can take to the grocer, and the grocer will accept it as legal tender. So that's basically the function of the bank is to we actually create the money ourselves. We, the borrowers, turn our own promises to pay into money, and the bank just makes it all official and makes it something that everybody can. The bank stands behind it, basically.
Yeah, it's our debt that allows them to create more money and to make more profit.
Right.
On something that didn't exist before we went into debt. So it's kind of a complicated idea. I know that you've done a lot of studying on this. Unfortunately, I haven't read your book, Web of Debt, but I did read David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, he says basically the reason money came into existence was because the monarchs and the rulers of the world back in, you know, whatever the civilizations were, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 years ago, had to have a way to pay mercenaries and to keep people in debt. And the only way that could be done efficiently is for them to print coins and create money. Otherwise, a mercenary, when he's done killing people out on the battlefield to maintain whatever that is that the monarch's trying to maintain, he goes back into the regular society with nothing. And when you have an agrarian society, that calls for some way for that person to function in regular society. Otherwise, of course, then they become murderers and thieves. And so the monarchs created money to pay off the mercenaries so that they could go back and spend that money back into the system so they could eat and, you know, become part of the monetary, the economic system. So what is, I know you've looked into some of the history of this. There's some pretty negative concepts attached to debt and money.
Right. Well, the American colonists did the same thing, and they came up with paper money. You don't actually have to have gold coins in order to pay your soldiers. In 1691, the governor of Massachusetts he was fighting a little border war, and he needed something to pay his soldiers with, and he couldn't find anybody to borrow from, so he got the bright idea that he would just write these little paper receipts called paper scrip. And because the soldiers were serving the community and everybody acknowledged that, they were willing to take this paper scrip in exchange for their goods and services. And because it would be accepted back in the payment of taxes, that's what allowed it to keep its value, more or less. That in the colonies, they tended to issue more paper scrip than they than they took back in taxes, because it was a lot easier to print than to collect it back. So they did tend to inflate the system. But in Pennsylvania and a couple of other colonies, they came up with a system where they created a land bank. So most of the money was printed and lent into the economy, and then it would be collected back with interest. So that was a quite sustainable system. I think I've gotten off your question, but
no, it's kind of in. Well, the other thing I was getting at is it was another way to, the debt itself was another way to enslave people. And that's true to today. I mean, in ancient times, you actually became an indentured servant or just a servant for life because you indebted yourself or your family, and one of your family members or yourself had to go into servitude through debt.
So, right. And
yeah.
Even today, you have in third world countries, you have people born into these huge debts that they're liable to pay. Artificial debts, you know, John Perkins has written about that, how we systematically locked third world countries in debt by selling them things they didn't really need, like a dam or something, where it would actually be Americans who would go in there and build the thing and who would get the money for it. So the IMF would make a loan, the Americans would go in and build it and get paid, and then the IMF, or the local people would have to pay off the loan, and the IMF was the enforcer. If it wasn't paid, in order to make sure they got payment, they would insist on these austerity measures where the local country would have to sell off its bus lines and its they would have to privatize their public goods, which serve the people. So now the people are paying much higher, whatever, bus rates and water prices, and so it's much more expensive for them to live, to pay off a debt that should never have been incurred in the first place. So the whole thing is quite fraudulent and unfair. If we had sort of a global justice system that actually worked, those would be called odious debts and they would be nullified. But we don't have the power. Anybody who tries to get out of those deals winds up at war, it seems. The U.S. obviously has the largest and most powerful military in the world, and that's how we enforce all these deals. But yes, historically, debt was a major source of slavery, that people got sold off into slavery. And so the basic problem with the system is that whenever, say somebody, the goldsmith or the whatever, the money lender would come to town and he'd lend his gold pieces, but there were never, if he lent 10 gold pieces and you had to pay 10% interest, you would have to pay back 11 gold pieces at the end of the year, and there was no 11th gold piece. So where are they going to get it? They either have to, somebody has to go into default, or they have to expand into other cities that have gold, which means they're taking from other people who have it. I mean, there's just not enough money in the system when you always require that more be paid back than you put out there in the first place. If the money lenders or the bankers or lenders in general are creating our money, and if they always require repayment that's larger than what they put out there, and virtually all of our money comes from them. And in fact, you know, over 30 years, you're paying back at least double, maybe more. So what you have is a pyramid scheme where it's not possible to sustain this debt. Eventually, it has to collapse. When you run out of workers and debtors to exploit, then the thing will collapse. So that's like we had the housing bubble. We locked the third world into debt until the 1997-98 Asian crisis. I mean, we've had different crises, the 2008 crisis.
Let me, we're just about at the bottom of the hour, so I have a couple of community announcements here to make, and then we'll come right back to our discussion with Ellen Brown. The Millville Historical Society has an open house and sale today. Saturday, June 7th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., and they're going to serve food from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. There's a raffle and chance to win an around-the-yard basket. I'm not sure what that means, but that includes items for your patio, your barbecue. And so this is taking place at not sure where here. This is not too clear. Anyway, you can get more information by calling Rod Miranda at 547-5619, 547-5619. That's ongoing today. Oh, here it is. Located in Millville, next door to the fire department on Whitmore Road. So that's in Millville, next door to the fire department on Whitmore Road. The Millville Historical Society's open house and sale. Next week, June 12th from 5 to 9 p.m. at the Wild Card Brewery, we're having a KKRN 88.5 FM concert. Well, it's a songwriter, singer-songwriter event with Jim Dyer, Tori Pratt, Jonathan Foster, Mark McAbee, Nick Campy, Michael Kellich, and they're going to be singing at the Wild Card Brewing Company. That's June 12th. That's next, Thursday or Friday. And there's a silent auction, food and beer. And so that's located at 9565 Crossroads Drive, Redding, California. And you can call 722-9239 for more information. So, and I think there's a charge at the door, but I'm not sure. But that's a fundraiser for KKRN. So please attend that and help us out. And we always have really good food and beer and wine to serve. And it should be really great entertainment. There's some good bands there. Well, let's get back to Ellen Brown. Ellen, we have a caller, and I want to take this caller on the air, and we'll see what types of questions they have for you. Yeah, it's our phone system is messed up here. He's on the phone line, but for some reason I have to get him away from our call screener in the other room, so we'll have to try that again. Well, where were we? We were talking about the evils of debt and how it's really not sustainable, and yet this is a system that we've had. So how do we how do we move away from this? Do you really think there's a way we can move away from this, or is this just going to go on from collapse to collapse, depression, recession, collapse? How do we correct the situation?
Well, you can make the system sustainable, and that is by returning the profits to the people. So the ideal model, which I've written quite a bit about, it was in Pennsylvania in Benjamin Franklin's time, where the colony owned the bank. It was called a land bank, although they didn't really sell land to back it. It was supposedly backed by land. And so what the government would do would be to print a certain amount of paper scrip. Say you would print $105 in paper scrip. Then you could lend $100 at 5%, and then you would spend the $5 on the government's budget, roads and bridges, and the things that people needed. So you would now have $105 out there to pay principal and interest. So all that money could come back, pay the loan off. Then you could pay, lend $100 again, spend $5, and it would all come back as principal and interest. I just mean this hypothetically, but you can see that if it all comes back to the lender, and if you put enough money out there to cover the interest as well as the principal, then you can have a sustainable system. And during the time that system was in place, the colonists paid no taxes except an excise tax on liquor, which was something that was disapproved. They had no government debt, and the money supply did not inflate.
It looks like our caller, we might be able to get him on the air. Let's try this again. Randy, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
What you described is this, this pyramid scheme, or it's like a giant shell game where everybody has to pay to be in it, but it never has to, turn the shell over because there's nothing under it. and it just keeps going. And so so obviously this is an international network now that's kind of you know, got hold of the world's economics, and obviously they're such a strong power that that they can get away with taking billions of dollars like they did in the collapse of Wall Street, and nobody has to face up to that. Now you mentioned that there are different ways that this one just that you mentioned about Benjamin Franklin. I'm just wondering, I see different banking systems here and there, like they call green banking. And are there any banking systems that are starting to develop that would be closer to the home of the people, more like community, you know, like just locally, more local to the communities, something closer to home than what we have now?
Well, that would be the ideal, to have a local system which does return the profits to the people. We haven't formed any local publicly owned banks, but there are people working on it, for example, in Philadelphia, in San Francisco, in Mendocino County, a number of smaller areas. And that actually is the most viable way to go, I think, because your politicians at a local level are more approachable. Now, you could do a private bank, but the trouble is, you have to come up with a lot of money to form the bank in the first place, and you'll be competing with the other private banks. So there's this race to the bottom where if your competitors are cheating in some way or doing something unscrupulous and you're not, you're going to lose in the competitive market. For example, I heard a lecture on this, if they're ignoring environmental standards, this is if you're a co-op and your competitors are ignoring environmental standards and you try to enforce them, you're going to have a competitive disadvantage and you're liable to be put out of business. So that's the beauty of a public banking system, that you have a huge capital and deposit base, potentially. You don't have to worry about where to get the money to start with. You've got all the government's revenues that you can run through this bank. And you have, I forgot what I was going to say, but anyway, there's much more potential there. And the good of a public system as well is that the profits are going to go back to the people collectively. So they will reduce your taxes, that they can use their credit power to make loans to homeowners and businesses. I mean, they can set it up various different ways, but in North Dakota, they make 1% loans to startup farmers and small businesses, and they make, I think, 1.73% loans to students, which is a quite good rate. And so they generally serve the community. They're right there when the event of crises, like when they had a big flood, the Bank of North Dakota went right in there and did a moratorium on foreclosures and made low-interest loans to everybody that needed to rebuild. So it's a very viable community-owned system. I mean, it's government-owned, but in North Dakota, the whole state is only one-fifth the size of Los Angeles, so it really is a community, and they serve their own. It's family style. They put the resources where they're needed.
Yeah, it seems ideal for people, of course, but yet, as I brought up before, that doesn't seem to be any part of the criteria in the economic circles, and the people that are running our governments don't seem to want to entertain that. As you brought up before, Jerry Brown just kind of threw the bill out the window and dismissed it, and there it sits, a wonderful idea that just been thrown in a trash can, unfortunately. And
Is that they just don't understand it, and that's why they haven't done it, because it really is in their best interest. And the state, California, we used to be the golden state, and now we're really, they've slashed services, laid off public employees, raised sales taxes. I mean, they're really in dire straits, and it would behoove them to do their own banking. They're getting I don't want to use the word screwed, I guess.
Well, I think that's okay. This isn't an adult show.
Okay.
And if any children are listening, cover your ears. So,
and those are crooks. I mean, there are several. I've seen several. In L.A., there were, I think, two councilmen, who were saying, why are we doing business with crooks? And there was an alderwoman in Chicago who brought they don't call it a bill, I don't remember what it was, but anyway, some sort of a proposal that they should formally discontinue working with JPMorgan Chase, because she said, we have a policy, it's a written policy, that we don't do business with crooks, and they've been proven to be fraudsters.
Well, and of course, the corruption in the banking system now is international. Like you pointed out, the IMF is basically what I would call a neoliberal scheme to indebt other nations. And the Ukraine, and we could take this latest crisis, which was created, of course, by whoever the powers that be are in the Ukraine. But part of that is who is going to indebt the people of the Ukraine and control that country. Am I right?
Sorry. What you repeat the question?
I was talking about what's happening with in the Ukraine. One reason that my understanding, one reason is that our State Department backed a coup there, and basically threw money at a bunch of fairly unethical politicians and thugs, was to make sure that the Ukraine became indebted to either the IMF or the banks in Europe through NATO, and that was kind of the ongoing scenario behind this. There's a banking scenario that's involved to indebt Ukraine for $18 billion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's been the scenario for decades, at least since the 1970s, that has been how we have gotten control over resources, is to get them heavily into debt to us.
Yeah, and it's not
necessarily. I shouldn't say us. It's the international bankers, whoever they are.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily. They're not the people in the country aren't the ones that get the money hardly ever. It's either the the corrupt elite at the top of their country, or as you say, it goes right back to some U.S. corporation. Kind of a handy money laundering scheme, if you might say, that they produce some product probably at a huge profit, a dam or something, and then that country becomes indebted, and after that, then it's just a scramble, or who gets to collect the debt and who controls the assets in that company or that country at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, in 2008, that the economic crash on Wall Street, the bailout, affected the whole world. And as far as I could tell, there was only one country that handled it well, and that was Iceland. And what they did is they prosecuted the bankers, and they defaulted on the phony debt that was created, and they turned right around and recovered very quickly from that.
Right, and that was a case of odious debt. They sued in some court, I think it was the European, I don't remember the name of the court, but they said, we, the people, did not take on this debt to pay for the liabilities of these banks, and this, you know, it's inappropriately imposed on us. It'll bankrupt us if we try to pay this off. And so they refused to pay it in the meantime, while they were waiting for this lawsuit. Unfortunately, the court finally agreed with them and said, that's right, you didn't take on that debt. So that's what I think everybody should do, is say, not pay and protest and say, and then go to court and say, this is inappropriate, we're not liable for these debts. But of course, I mean, a government can do that, even though Iceland is very small. I mean, it's like the size of a city, a modest-sized city. And people collectively usually can't. We're not that organized. That is one problem. We don't really have representation of the 99%. Mm. And that goes back to this whole now, for example, in California, the top two primary will knock out any possible representation of the specifically of the 99%, you know, as opposed to the big corporate parties, which might take our concerns into consideration, but mostly will get railroaded by the big corporations.
Let me take a moment here to remind the listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Our guest today is Ellen Brown, attorney, author, journalist, and previously candidate for treasurer. Apparently, she's been knocked out by our new so-called open primary system that we have in California now. And we're talking about the economy, too big to fail banks, and possible solutions. Well, that brings me to another thing. We all pretty much sort of understand what happened in the bailout there in 2008 and 2009. Hundreds of billions of dollars handed over to banks, which then consolidated their positions, and it became even bigger and even harder to not bail out or prosecute. But there's a new thing, and maybe somebody told me this, and it's really scary. What is a bail-in? We kind of know what the bailout is. That's where the government gives the banks money. What is a bail-in?
Bail-ins are the latest thing, and we'll be seeing that, it appears. A bail-in is where the presumption is that these banks are too big to fail, and they have to balance their books one way or another. So with the bailout, they balance their books by getting the government to pad the asset side of their balance sheet. And if the government wouldn't do it, the Federal Reserve stepped in and made these extremely cheap loans and bought toxic assets off their books to improve the asset side of their balance sheet. So when that, but now, like in 2010, the Dodd-Frank Bill Act says that we, the people, will not be responsible for bailing out the big banks in the future. They don't really solve this problem. I mean, there could be future collapses. They didn't solve any of those problems. All they did was basically say, we're just not going to pay it next time. So then where do they get the money? So in Dodd-Frank, it specifically states, although you have to be able to read whatever I would call it legalese, but it's mm-hmm. bankerese, you have to be able to read between the lines for what they're saying. It says that now the big banks have to come up with a way to save themselves some other way. So what they will do and what they're actually instructed to do is to bail in the money of their creditors. Well, the creditors include the shareholders, the bondholders, and the depositors. In fact, the depositors, it turns out, are the largest class of creditor of any bank. People think that when they put their money in the bank, it's still theirs, and that the bank is there to protect the money. But that's not true. When you put your money in the bank, legally, it becomes the property of the banks. And what you have is an IOU. You're a creditor of the bank. So in a bail-in, we first saw it in Cyprus, where they took, originally they were going to take a percentage of all the deposits, insured and uninsured, but there was a huge furor over that. The people took to the streets and the government said, we're not going to do it. I mean, the government itself was balking against doing what the Troika was requiring them to do, which is the European Central Bank, the IMF, and the European Commission. They were going to force this deal on Cyprus, and the Cyprus politicians said, we're not going to do it. So what they finally did was they imposed this bail-in on the uninsured depositors, which was everybody over 100,000 euros, which, you know, and in the U.S., the FDIC insurance covers $250,000. But they will actually, they even in the U.S., they would still get everybody if you had a serious big bank collapse, because under the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, derivatives claims go first in bankruptcy. So let's say that J.P. Morgan Chase or Bank of America were to be rendered insolvent. They both have over $70 trillion in derivatives. And these are largely the banks themselves. They're the mm-hmm. counterparties on these derivatives claims.
Mm-hmm.
So they get to snatch the collateral before anybody else. So there's just not going to be the money left to pay the insured deposits. The FDIC is one of the parties in a bankruptcy, and they would put in their claim. But they too are going to be behind the derivatives claims, and the money just might be gone. Even the state and local governments who think they have secured deposits may find that all the security's gone by the time they get up to the front of the line. So it seems to me that that's when we're liable to see some radical change here, when people actually open their computer screens to see what they have in their bank accounts, and it says zero, or it says much less than what they thought was there. That will wake people up. People will suddenly take a serious interest in how banking works and what just happened here, and we might see some radical change. That's my hope. I mean, not that I want to see it go that far, but if things don't seem to be moving before that, it seems to me that would move things.
So these bail-in policies are already in effect all over America?
It's part of the Dodd-Frank Act, yeah. That's what they're supposed to do.
That was supposed to be the reform. Wasn't the Dodd-Frank Act supposed to be the bank reform?
Right. So it's saying we're not going to impose it on the taxpayers. We're going to impose it on the depositors.
Well, you know, it makes me want to do? I'm going to go. Why isn't this creating a run on the banks? I'm going to go take some money out of the bank myself.
Yeah. No, you're well advised not to keep very much money in the bank. I mean, even if it's like totally convenient to use Chase or something, just keep what you need to pay your bills and nothing else.
Yeah, that's really that's pretty scary because you're not only going to get radical change, but you're going to make a lot of people instantly poor. And
it's the poor who probably keep their money in the bank. I mean, most people with a lot of money, they don't keep $250,000 in the bank. Of course, businesses do because they need that for the cash flow, and that's what that's who got hit in Cyprus. We tend to think, well, it was the Russian oligarchs and they deserved it or something.
Yeah, that was
the
story.
But the Russian oligarchs were a small percentage of their depositors. It was mainly their local businesses, and they really got taken. They had 60% of their deposits got wiped out.
Yeah, and so it just harmed a country that was already so badly in debt.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty discouraging. I was hoping you were going to tell me there was some really good way to avoid this bail-in, but it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like the people that have been the most frugal and, you know, trying to prepare for their future by saving a little money, having a little cash. So it's interesting to me because I'm thinking, so what would I do with it? Am I going to go out and buy treasury notes and just stack them in my safe somewhere? Or what does a person do with their money in America under these circumstances?
Yeah, I know. People ask me that, and I hesitate to say because it's not my line of work.
Well, yeah.
I haven't always made the best investment decisions myself. So.
Yeah.
I mean, at the moment, the stock market actually is your best investment, but I don't want to recommend that.
Well, even at that, if you're a real, if you really look at it, it's falsely inflated. It's the values there don't represent the true values in the world. So that'd be another place, and especially if we have a major crash of any kind, that'll fall to pieces too. So then, what have you got? Some worthless stock, or you know what's happens at that point? Well, look, we have another caller. Almost, yeah, we do. And I'm going to take this call, and he has a question for you. Dennis, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. This is Dennis. I have a question. You've successfully scared the shit out of me.
I wish I could bleep that, but I'm not quick enough. All right.
Anyway, someone who's retired and has a lot of money, like in 401ks or whatever, Where do you put that money? What would you suggest the best place to put it? I've heard people say buy gold or buy assets. What do you do to protect yourself if there's a collapse like that?
Yeah, well, I hesitate to give advice because, yeah. I mean, I'm just an ordinary, well, my own money is in the stock market, and it keeps going up, so I don't sell it, but I know it's a risky thing to do, but it, apparently everybody's flooding into the stock market because there are no other good investments. You can't make much money on bonds. That things like pension funds, they have to make a certain percentage. And they can't make it in the old ways. And in fact, I did see a really good article on bail-ins that said that the old things that used to be considered risky are now the better investments. That it used to be that if the investment is somebody else's liability, such as bonds or deposits, you're at risk because the liability might get wiped out. But if So what you want are assets today, and the assets would include stocks, gold and silver, houses, things that used to be considered speculative, but today are actually less risky than the things that used to be considered safe.
Yeah, if there was a collapse, I've heard about real estate, but typically a collapse causes a depression. Everything is going to depress, including real estate, the stock market. But I guess it's better than zero. I mean, if everything goes down in value, at least there's some value to it if it's in an asset. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could buy a couple years' worth of food and water. You could bunker in. But we only have a couple more minutes, so I want to give Ellen a chance to just kind of get her last few words in here, and then the show will be over. Thank you for that question, Dennis, and I think it's one we all have to ask ourselves.
Yeah,
thank you.
I'm asking myself, too.
All right.
Well, I'll just mention my websites. I'm the founder of the Public Banking Institute, and it has lots of information on public banking. So its website is publicbankinginstitute.org, and my own blog is ellenbrown.com, and I've got over 200 articles on there that I've written. And then my books are Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution in this particular subject. I've actually written 12 books.
Well, I want to thank you, Ellen, for being on Unspun and an experiment in truth telling this morning. I think it's you've got a few of us shook up here, and rightfully so. And hopefully other people that hear the broadcast appreciate your research and your writings. And I'll put links to your websites and to your other works. And that music you hear in the background, that's our cue to close it down. So I'm going to have to say goodbye and thank you once again.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was Ellen Brown, webofdebt.com, and what's the other one? Publicbankinginstitute.com. So we've only got a couple seconds. You've been listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Tune in again next week, Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. Thanks for being with us.